This is a CBC podcast.
Welcome to a special holiday edition of Power and Politics. I'm David Cochrane. In just over 2 weeks, the Liberal government will table what could be this government's final budget. It comes as Canadians face an ongoing affordability crisis, from housing to groceries to filling their tanks. Many Canadians are struggling to make ends meet. Will Finance Minister Chrystia Freeland put anything new on the table? And what do the other parties want to see? It's time to check the political pulse of the parties as we head towards Budget 2024. I'm joined by our three party insiders. Greg McEachern is a former Liberal ministerial staffer. Melanie Richet is a former communications director for the NDP. And Fred DeLory is a former Conservative campaign manager. Now, during the show, we're going to assess the state of each of the parties. Let's start with the governing Liberals.
Even though we have a lot of work to do, Canada is not broken.
Justin Trudeau is not worth the cost.
And the other piece that we're really pushing for is real action on housing.
Block your $20 billion of inflationary spending and the rest of your economically destructive plans.
The foundation of our fall economic statement is our responsible fiscal plan.
And if he really wants to contest and argue that he should be able to raise the tax, why doesn't he have the courage to call an election and let Canadians decide?
An election on the price on pollution? We had three, Mr. Speaker, and we won them all.
Then he shouldn't be afraid to have one more.
All right, some of the highlights of the first quarter of the year as we get ready for the budget. Greg, you can see Fred how excited he got when Chrystia Freeland mentioned the fall economic statement. But we're past that. That's in the rearview mirror. Let's talk about where your crowd is right now. Where are the Liberals right now? How have things gotten better, gotten worse, or stabilized for them since the new year began?
Stabilized polling. So, you know, whether this is the basement or not, I think Liberals would like it to be the basement?
Yeah,
like,
I think
please,
so.
No
yeah.
more.
Yeah.
But we're not seeing the breathless coverage of polling because it kind of has stabilized. And, you know, you can argue whether or not coverage of bad polls begets more bad polling, but that's kind of taken a second place. We saw so much media coverage that was driven through the lens of, you know, the horse race. Liberals, to their credit, have stayed on the issue of housing and affordability. And you can argue whether or not people are mad about housing and affordability or they're just mad because, you know, Sean Fraser has done, I think, well over 100 announcements. And then if you do the province-wide in Quebec, which is many more communities,
right.
You know, so they're looking at, I think, over 100,000 new builds with, over the next decade, over 750,000 builds over the next decade. And when you look at where Canada has come over the last 40 years, we really need this. It's going to move slow. But they've stayed on that. Has it paid off in the polls? No. Or you can argue that perhaps that they've stabilized. They've had a couple of own goals. Ministers and MPs speaking out at a time when it was not helpful. Guy Beau on speculating about highway projects, supposedly speaking specifically in Quebec outside of his portfolio. Rob Oliphant had a couple as well. And I hear from Liberals outside the bubble all the time who, when they hear things like this, they ask, you know, is my party, do they have their head in the game? Mm-hmm. But for the most part, those were not huge, and they've kind of stayed on the important stuff, which what we're told is important, housing and affordability.
Right. So, Mel, Greg seems to feel that they've found a focus. Mm-hmm. They've stabilized. Maybe rock bottom stabilizes you, because I don't know if 23%, 24%, we've seen a Liberal Party much lower than that, so there's nowhere to go but up for them. What's your sense of what the first quarter of this year has been like for the government?
Right. So where I agree with Greg is I think they may have figured out what it is that they want to talk about. I don't know that they've actually had much success in punching through with what it is that they want to talk about. And that, you know, could be because they're having to react to different things, or also just because they haven't been focused enough on what the message is in a way that people can perhaps understand it or hear it. You know, seeing Minister Freeland talk about the fall economic statement, I think one big thing that they need to focus on, especially as they're looking towards the budget and post the budget, is not responding to people in the same way that they responded with the fall economic statement. I think back in the fall, what we heard was everything's great here. So it'll be interesting to see how they position themselves going into the budget and coming out of it, because if that's the same response, I think people will be even more turned off than they were back then. So I think that'll be interesting to see how they talk about measures of housing and affordability in a way that's, we hear you, we hear your concerns, here's what we're doing to make it better. So I think they really need to focus on that and push that forward if they want to be successful going into the next election. We are, you know, if it is October 2025, we're a year and a half away from the next one and from Rich Drop. So how do you start now and saying, hey, this is our vision of what the country should look like in 2025, and here's our plan to get there. I don't know that we've totally seen that. So I think the next few weeks and the next quarter is really an opportunity that the Liberals have to do that.
Fred, they're focusing on some key things, but not pivoting on big things like their climate plan and other things in the face of growing opposition. But they've satisfied, to this point, the conditions of the supply and confidence agreement with the NDP. So some success is there inside Parliament, but outside Parliament, how are they doing with the rest of the country?
Right. To your point, they are keeping this government alive for another year and a half, but it's on life support because they're not doing well outside of Parliament. And I don't think we've seen bottom yet on where these polling numbers are.
Really? You think they could go below like 22, 23, 24?
Absolutely. I think Quebec is the one province that has not shifted drastically that could. I think it'll be during a campaign that we'll see it. I think when that blue wave comes, and it's building, this is a big blue wave coming. And it could sweep Quebec, which happens every 40 or 50 years, and we're right on the clock for that. I think the Liberals can go way further down. If you recall, go back to the Harper years. Governments eventually tire and wear out. The Harper government went through the same thing, but we were never as low that where the Liberals are. We were never in third. I know the NDP are eating into this Liberal vote, and they're not that far behind. So I think the Liberals could continue to go if they don't get a story together, if they don't get their purpose, if they don't have a vision that they can actually sell to Canadians. You know, the government seems to be working hard on all these different projects, but they're not putting it in one package to say, hey, we have a plan, we're doing something.
So Greg, on that, I mean, what is the vibe inside Liberal ranks? Are they worried they could slip even further? Or they feel like they've settled at a floor and now it's to fight your way back to competition? What is the view inside the party?
I use the example of the Manitoba provincial election when the then governing PCs decided to do billboards about the women who were...
The landfill.
Yeah, murder victims suspected of being in a landfill. And I remember at the time of the fall economic statement saying, you know, on this panel, like, make sure that you're not chasing polls. So I think, you know, they've decided that they're not going to do anything more on carbon pricing. They took their hits for home heating oil. And again, being from the East Coast and knowing how expensive oil is, doesn't matter what part of the country you live in, I think that's been well litigated. But it also shows that they've decided that that's our principle. We're going to stay there and we're not going to move anymore. I think if you start to chase polling, people are forgetting that you might be sitting in opposition for a long time and you're going to have those, you know, I think it was a dumb decision in Manitoba to do those billboards. I think the outgoing premier apologized for them. There was a lot of, that's a great example to me of what not to do. So I think they have to kind of stay the course. I said recently in an interview to a reporter, I'm a bad partisan here because I'm going to, you know, say, yes, my party could lose. And the reporter said, no, you're a great partisan. I said, well, not to other Liberal partisans, perhaps.
Yeah.
But the reality is, I mean, what if the Liberals are able to hold, they lose and they want to hold the party that wins to a minority? You want to make sure that everything you're doing for the next, you know, however long this government lives is... are going to be items that you're proud of. I mean, for a long time, Liberals were able to point to childcare and the Kelowna Accord. You know, it was kind of like what kept them alive in opposition. I think that right now they have to be really, really, you know, straight and true to their beliefs and thinking about we may be answering for this for a long time.
Core values and core policies, no matter what the numbers are. Fred, you wanted to say something about chasing polls.
I fully agree with what Greg said there. If the Liberals were to move off of these top issues that they believe in, it'd be catastrophic for them to the point where they would deserve to come in third or fourth in the next election. What they need to do is to find the messages that work with this. You know, we talked about the carbon tax. Pierre Poilievre and the Conservatives have owned that issue right now. And if this is a Liberal issue, they should find a way to own it. We've seen hints of that. They seem to be trying with new branding of it. But it's one of those things where if they were to abandon their principles here, then they are definitely toast.
So, Mel, we'll go out on this. Just a thought from you. You talked about how they've found the things they want to talk about. they haven't had a message that punches through. Mm-hmm. Have they got the right messengers? That's a question I wonder if needs to be asked.
That's a really good question. You know, we've seen a lot of polling that shows that people are just really upset with the prime minister. And you know, putting the prime minister out as your primary spokesperson, I think, needs to happen as it relates to you're kind of fighting an election where the conservatives are very focused on the leader. So if you don't have a leader-to-leader kind of messaging, I think there's a downfall there. But when people are so upset, I think there's probably questions that need to be asked. And I think we've seen members of caucus ask those questions, or, you know, liberals within you know, government or without, asking those questions too. But he is still, I think, when it comes to campaigning, you know, he's scrappy. He's good in campaigning.
That's but beyond the prime that. Minister. I mean, you know, they did their shuffle last year. Have they got the right people in the right places to be the messengers on the right files? Right. It's unclear.
You know, I think they have found maybe some better messengers in, you know, Minister Fraser and Minister O'Regan. I'll go back to my earlier comments about Minister Freeland not totally hitting it on where people are feeling. So maybe we see some changed message from Minister Freeland. But and this may be contrary to folks in my universe, but Minister Fraser's video that he did, you know, not that long ago on housing, I thought was quite compelling. Mm-hmm. You know, people, I think, within the bubble are like, oh, it was so late in comparison to Poilievre. And I don't think people, you know, real folks at home are looking at that. So I thought that that message was compelling. And maybe we see more of Minister Fraser, but it's always, you know, who do you put out there? Who's resonating with people? And I think that's a challenge that they're going to have until the next one.
Yeah, but, you know, they have upped their social media game, and they are fighting back, which a lot of liberals look at and say, finally. Yeah, exactly. Welcome back to this special holiday edition of Power and Politics. We're checking the political pulse here in Ottawa and looking at what's in store for the upcoming budget 2024. Conservative leader Pierre Poilievre is shaping the political narrative on Canada's affordability crisis, calling on the Liberals to fix the budget and bring down inflation, and framing the carbon tax as the number one affordability issue for Canadians.
There will be a carbon tax election. I will win the carbon tax election, and whether you like it or not, I will axe the tax.
Conservative politicians are arguing that Canada needs to do less to fight climate change.
There is only one party that will axe the carbon tax, only one party that has stood up and fought this tax every step of the way.
Unlike the Conservatives, whose goal is just to force an election, our goal is to force this government to work for people.
Mr. Speaker, it took him 8 years to cause this housing hell. How long will it take to fix it?
The opposition leader's bickering won't help get houses built. Our plan does.
Why don't we just end the debate and let Canadians decide and have a carbon tax election?
All right, back with me now are our political insiders, Greg McKecker, Melanie Richie, and Fred Delory. Fred, I want to start with you. I mean, I think Pierre Poilievre may want to axe the tax. I think that's something we've definitely heard over the first part of this year.
I think that's still on the agenda.
Where are the Conservatives? They've locked in at good numbers, 40 and above in all the polls.
Yeah, look, they're still firing on all cylinders. They're getting better as the year goes on in terms of their narrative and their messaging. They have the four pillars that they're campaigning on. That's very memorable and easy for MPs and candidates to push out. They're in full campaign mode, pushing out their message. And I still think there's room to grow. At the same time, we have to be aware that election is a year and a half away. Despite my optimism, things could go sideways quickly if the Liberals ever, one, figure out how to campaign again, and two, if our, you know, there's a lot of criticisms about the tone of the party and how aggressive we are. Not just with media, but in many ways. And it's something that does concern some folks internally as well. And that's what we saw last fall with the multi-million dollar ad campaign to soften the image. And it was for good reason, right? You know, we had the by-elections last spring that the tone and the negatives from the party still linger. And it's one of those things. Right now, people are parking their vote with us. We could lose that if we're not careful over the next year and a half. So, though I think it's good that the, you know, the party has its message, it's hammering it, keep doing that, but it's got to be cautious in how it does it.
Yeah, Mel, it's been a pretty remarkable demonstration of message discipline and topic discipline. Mm-hmm. But, you know, as Fred outlined, there is some vulnerabilities there. Where do you think those might be for the Conservatives?
Absolutely. I'll pick up on your mention of tone. You know, the clip that we just saw of Pierre Poilievre saying, you know, I don't care if you like it or not, it's gone. I can't help but think that that message must resonate a lot with, you know, conservative partisans or folks that are fundraising and giving to the Conservative campaign. But I can't imagine that that is salient with, you know, regular people who don't consider themselves partisan and who are looking for a prime minister that brings people together. I can imagine that, you know, I don't care if you like it or not, is not something that will bring those soft voters on side. So I see your point of, you know, if they're not careful, if they don't become more bringing people together, propositional, I think that that's a risk for sure.
So the issue isn't the axing of the tax. It's the I don't care if you like it or not that you think people might not like.
Yeah,
am I understanding that right?
Yeah, like I think, and you know, we've talked about this before, I feel like the conservative messaging as it relates to the carbon tax has, you know, gone their way. They they have kind of had a free range of saying what they want to say. And I think that that with most folks is starting to resonate a little bit. And I think that that doesn't help that there's kind of the people who are for this are not being very effective with why they want to push forward for a carbon tax. And so I think that on this front, I think that people are nodding their heads and are paying attention to what Piapoyev says. But I think the tone, the you know, I'm going to fight everything or I'm going to, you know, do it whether you like it or not. Nobody says, I think that can only get you so far. I think that, you know, the closer we get to the election, I think the more you have to bring people in. And that kind of language, at least for the folks in my universe, would be like, oh, come on, this guy's not serious. Right. Or this guy can't be prime minister. He's going to be opposition leader forever. So I think that that kind of stuff in the efforts that they have done to soften his image, to, you know, make him more receptive to women in particular, I think that that kind of language is going to turn people off the closer we get to the election instead of bringing people in and keeping them in.
Okay. Fred, do you want to just respond to that before I go to Greg?
Yeah. There's just the interesting part, though, and I know I brought up tone. There is a huge part of this population that wants to see a decisive leader. Mm. And that's something that I think a lot of people feel has been missing. So though there are some risks to it, there is a lot of reward, too. So it's finding that balance and making sure you don't cross the line. Right. But there is, you know, I remember when Paul Martin was finance minister, he was a cool, calculated guy. He looked like he was a decisive leader. When he became prime minister, he washed away.
Mm. He was called Mr. Dithers by the economists.
So the strong leader, people like that.
Right. Okay, Greg?
Decisive doesn't mean angry. Mm. And sometimes people confuse strength with anger. And there's a lot of anger right now. In that clip of the conservative leader, you hear the word I a lot. I. And we've not really had a good head-to-head comparison of him and other leaders. We saw the ads that they did last fall, and the Conservatives spent a lot of money to tell us that this is a nice guy who does puzzles with two-year-olds, but he's not actually acted anything close to that. Mm. And if you look at him, you know, what are his hobbies that we know of? Well, he likes to watch YouTube videos on crypto. I think a lot of Canadians are going to say that's weird. Like, what did Trudeau put out there? Well, he likes to run, he likes to box, and he likes to spend time with his kids. So at a certain point, people look that they want to identify with whoever's going to be their prime minister. I think recently, during the Mulroney funeral, Andrew Scheer's Twitter account tweeted a really negative thing about the prime minister, about crime, while he was sitting in a pew at a funeral mass. Now, I don't think that Andrew Scheer did that, but somebody on his team did. And that was pointed out to me by a conservative as an example that this group does not know an off switch. Mm. It is on all the time. And quite often, they push it too far and they jump the shark. You can use catchphrases, but there's a reason why Wendy's stopped using "Where's the beef?" And I've probably just lost anybody that's younger than a Generation X.
Yeah.
But you know, these three word things work for a while, but they also they work well because they work fast and they also have a very short shelf life.
So Fred, on that, on tone, you can look angry as a leader if the country is angry, right? Maybe that meets the moment. It's not a criticism of Mr. Poilievre. It's just like, you know, maybe he is capturing a lot of the sentiment that's out there. But can you sustain that for another 18 months? And this permanent campaign footing that you pointed to, it is every minute of every day, nonstop. Can you sustain that for 18 months up into an election? It's tough.
Having known Pierre Poilievre for 20 years, I think he can sustain it. He is a political animal who you know, his main hobby is obviously he spends a lot of time with his family, but politics is his entire life. It's been his entire career. The only time he ever leaves the house other than with family stuff, is for politics. He doesn't have a social life outside of this. This is who he is. It's how he's wired. So I definitely think he mentally and physically can do that. On the slogans and what they're pushing and on the anger, they've certainly tapped into a major issue in this country where people are feeling beaten and defeated. If that flips, if the Liberals somehow, again, get their act together and tell a story and if people's hopes rise, then, yeah, that becomes a concern for the Conservatives. There's no question. And at the same time, though, Poilievre, I think, is up to the challenge to maybe pivot to fit that as well.
Greg, he has his focus on the four things, and it doesn't really go beyond that, at least not right now. I mean, how do you maintain just focusing on houses, crime, budget, tax? That's it, when there are other issues that have a way of intruding as you go through life.
Well, for one, you don't have that luxury when you're in government. We've talked lots of times on this panel about how the government wants to stay on message on a certain narrative and world events. You know, when you think about in the last 4 years what we've experienced, who knew that we'd be in another Middle East crisis, a war in Europe, a crisis in Haiti, and just finished a pandemic. So, you know, the old saying about events, dear boy, events, I mean, that is something that could also knock them off message. And I would add, you know, the Conservatives' treatment of the media with disdain, although they like to use media clips when it, you know, pumps up their message. But there comes a time where you're not going to be able to handle an issue by a tweet or by a press release. And you can push it for a couple of days, but you're hiding out from reporters and you're not getting your own message out. So, you know, part of the reason why even somebody like, you know, Brian Mulroney, who had a lot of issues with the media, eventually you know when and how you want to speak to them because you need some assistance in getting your message across.
Yeah. So, Mel, in terms of the vulnerabilities for the Conservatives, it seems to be cell phones and self-mistakes or external events. I've not heard anything that the NDP and the Liberals are doing to derail Pierre Poilievre. Just as a final point, what are your thoughts there?
Yeah, I think that you've nailed it. I think, and we've seen this really from the beginning of Pierre Poilievre's leadership, where, you know, Pierre Poilievre has been in politics his whole life. There is a lot that both the Liberals and the NDP can point to with voters and say, hey, this guy is trying to rebrand himself, but look what he's done that has harmed you, that has hurt your family, that has harmed your community. And instead, since he's been leader, Pierre Poilievre has been able to totally brand himself the way that he's wanted to, almost unopposed. And there have been efforts, absolutely, from you know, the Liberals and the NDP, but they haven't been successful in doing
that. Or sustained.
Or sustained in doing that, yeah. Absolutely. And I think we're starting to see a little bit of that. They're starting to see, okay, well, what shots can we take in what lands? But because they haven't done it in a sustained way, I think we're again, it's a little bit too late by now. So I think that'll be definitely something to pay attention to in the next little bit to see if he just continues to run away the way that he wants to or if there's a little bit more opposition there.
Yeah, look, the slogans, people like to make fun of them, but when everyone else in professional circles are sick of hearing it, a huge chunk of the population is only starting to hear for the first time. It's just the way it goes. Welcome back to this special holiday edition of Power and Politics. Today, we're assessing the state of politics and looking ahead to Budget 2024. There has been progress on some of the key pillars of the Liberal NDP Supply and Confidence Agreement, including legislation for the first phase of National Universal Pharmacare and a plan for the rollout of the new federal dental program. In terms of new spending measures in this budget, pharmacare could very well be the centerpiece. But how much could the program be expanded, and what will it take for the Liberals to hold on to the support of the NDP?
We've seen what's possible when we use our power as New Democrats to force the government to help people.
A costly coalition of Justin Trudeau and the NDP.
The agreement gives us the ability to negotiate and force this government to do more.
When will the Prime Minister stop dividing the country and put in place a measure that gives relief to all Canadians?
Absolutely not be any other carve-outs.
Why does this government wait until things are at a breaking point before acting?
We don't agree with the Liberals' divisive tactics. We don't agree with the climate denial of the Conservatives. We have our own path.
Okay, back with me are our political insiders, Greg McKechnie, Melanie Richet, and Fred Delory. Mel, I'm always amazed at how angry Jagmeet Singh is with a prime minister who gives him exactly what he wants.
You know, it's an amazing dynamic to watch in what they do in terms of advancing policy and legislation, and then the political dance that they have to go through in public each and every day. Mm-hmm. Where are things?
Yeah, and it is exactly that. It is a dance that they have to do. And I'm going to go back to where the NDP comes from, and that's the labor movement. And, you know, what we say there, it's better to have a seat at the table than, you know, to be only screaming from the outside. Now, of course, you're saying he's doing both things here. And I think what's important to point out is the NDP kind of has two audiences of people that they need to talk to. They need to talk to Orange Red voters, you know, people in Toronto, people in Halifax, people in Montreal who have some room for the Liberals, who have some sympathy for the Liberals, but think that the Liberals don't do enough for them in a way that makes a difference in their day-to-day lives. So Jagmeet is talking to those people, or the NDP is talking to those people, but they also have to talk to that orange-blue voter, which is a lot of the voters that they were able to bring over in some of the ridings that they have now in the last election. Right. So Vancouver Island, you have some of that in Northern Ontario, Southern Ontario, et cetera, which are really displeased by what the government's doing and, you know, displeased with the prime minister. So there's absolutely a dance there. But Jagmeet has to do it, right? He has to say both those things in a way that's not contradictory. And I get that sometimes is a little bit difficult, but it is key in shifting things for the NDP. I'll go back to, and I think I said this, you know, a while ago, what was important for the NDP in the last election was, what can we do to change our votes here, to get more people on side? And what they looked at is polling continued to show that Jagmeet was everybody's favorite leader. People really liked him. People would want to go for a drink with him, but they didn't think that he was credible as prime minister. So how do you change that? And you know, back in the day, the way that you change that is you work with the government and you are able to say on a large scene, on the governing, the day-to-day governing for people, here is Jagmeet making decisions that benefit you and that benefit you in a real way. And then the dance of, well, then how do you continue to speak to those orange-blue voters? I think one thing that I've noticed, and I noticed this even at the NDP convention in the fall, is our own people, New Democrats, didn't know all of the things that Jagmeet right. and the NDP is doing. And in fact, you know, I live in Ottawa Centre, which right now is a Liberal MP that represents it. I hear more about dental care from that Liberal MP than I sometimes hear from New Democrats.
But this
MPs.
Was the warning with the whole supply and confidence agreement, totally. Is that you're going to advance your ideas and the Liberals are going to take credit for all
totally.
Of it. And that seems to be what may be happening with some of these.
And you know, this is par for the course for New Democrats. This isn't a new thing, but I think in the absence of the NDP's own people, and I don't mean the leader here, I mean, you know, caucus members, I mean folks across the country, of knowing exactly what the NDP was able to get and, you know, screaming it from the rooftops, right. there's absolutely a risk of totally losing that momentum to the Liberals.
Okay, Greg, I'm gonna get to the other half of the coalition just so I know it's not a coalition, it's a joke. But Fred, I want to start with you. You next. You talked about polling for the Liberals. In the first segment. The polling for the NDP is close to the Liberals, but it's still sub 20%. And I know there were warnings from people who wanted this government to continue when this agreement was signed that it wouldn't necessarily benefit either one of them and would kind of tie them together and maybe drag them down. What do you think the net effect of this has been? They've advanced on policy, but they're both headed for pretty rough elections if it doesn't change.
Yeah, I think one of the big issues is, we talked about tone earlier, I think the biggest issue with Jagmeet's tone is he doesn't look sincere. He doesn't come across as sincere when he's saying two very different things. You see him talking about working with government, getting things done, and then really over-the-top attacks on Trudeau that, you know, may agree with his attacks, but they don't fit with...
He's not getting your vote, no matter what he says.
He just doesn't seem sincere when you're talking out of two sides of your mouth this way. And I think that's a big problem. And if you look at what the NDP are doing in other parts of the country, look at Western Canada, where they're in government in two provinces, knocking on the door in two other provinces. If they had a prairie populist type leader, this could be their time. Because right now, the Conservative Party is eating that Labour vote that used to at least be more comfortable with the NDP. Poilievre is eating that. This is an opportunity going into the next election, though. We look at Poilievre's at 41%. 59% or not with Poilievre. Where's that 59%? Are we going to see something where does Jagmeet Singh catch fire and run an amazing campaign and eat that Liberal vote, just like Jack Layton did in 2011? Or will people be afraid of the Conservatives and say, we better park that vote with the Liberals to stop them, and then eat the NDP mm-hmm. vote. There's lots of different scenarios that could happen here. Or are they both going to run up the middle and tie and allow us to come up the middle? Sorry, mm-hmm. That's great too.
Well, so. I think this has to be the concern, doesn't it, Greg? Right? That the supply and confidence agreement has lengthened the parliament, but there's been an erosion of support for both of the parties who were tied to that agreement, even as they deliver on the things that they said they would deliver on, at least in the initial phases of it. I mean, what's your sense of how the NDP are benefiting from this and how the Liberals, are they taking advantage of some of these ideas to exploit it?
I'm not sure the NDP are benefiting from this. And it's funny to hear Mel talk about the inability to get a message out or Fred talk about the bad polling of the NDP. Thank goodness the Liberals are there to, like, just suck up all the oxygen around those types of situations where nobody else wants to, you know, nobody else is paying attention to those. I mean, the challenge is the clip you just showed. What was used? Angry images from Singh. Instead of the message about, look at what we accomplished. And, you know, to use a cliche, you get more with honey than with vinegar. Well, we have a vinegar approach from the leader of the Conservatives. And if I was the NDP, I'd be looking at the honey approach and saying, look, this government is here. This is what we have. I understand that they're trying to take advantage of the bad polling of the Liberals and echo that message. But I would, if I were the NDP, I'd be saying, look, we are making the best of a bad situation and we're delivering for you. There's a famous quote from Tip O'Neill, all politics is local. Mm. Right now, if you look at the polls, and I'm sure Liberals are doing the same thing, you're looking at what seats are we not in trouble with? And I'd be starting with those areas and saying, look, this is what we've delivered, and we need you to keep supporting us and then build outwards. But if you sound like, you know, a less strident version of the Conservative leader, you sound like an echo message. It's not a new message. And I think the NDP have missed huge opportunities to do victory laps around dental care. There's still work to do on dental care. There was a story the other day about dentists and PEI, for example. This is something that the NDP could work on, whether in tandem with the Liberals or not, to make sure that the plan that, you know, took a lot of work to get to is actually going to work.
So Mel, on that, they've signed on to the supply and confidence agreement to get big things done that will make a big difference in Canadians' lives. And on that point, if the messaging is, this prime minister is so awful, then the value of the programs you've co-negotiated can't punch through, right? You know, because you're undermining each other, mm-hmm. which then taints what you've done together, doesn't it? Like, I just wonder about the effectiveness of this approach. And I know you want to appeal to your blue-collar, you know, labor root activists, but you've got an urban progressive leader, right, which doesn't necessarily align with that. So how do you make all of this work through this discordancy?
Mm-hmm. I definitely think that there is room there to get better, and there's still a little bit of a runway to do that. Mm-hmm. I think I point to what usually works for New Democrats, and I point to this moment where, you know, the Conservatives are doing so well, and the Conservatives are able to tap into that anger. And in the next election, you know, the Prime Minister is not going to easily be able to offer something that is kind of similar to Pierre Poilievre, but different enough where folks who are paying attention to Pierre Poilievre will be able to say, you know what, yes, I'm with you. Whereas the NDP is able to talk to the same amount of people in that way. And I point to what happened in Manitoba where, you know, Premier Canoe was able to tap into that anger, but instead of being that angry, he was able to mm-hmm. tap into that anger and kind of position it to hope, position it to here are the things that we can do together and bring people together.
Like Jack Layton, like Trudeau in
exactly.
2015,
exactly.
That positive change message.
Yes, exactly. Right? The I hear you, things are bad, mm-hmm. and here's how we're going to make it better. And I think Jagmeet, naturally, is that's where he is really good. He's super compelling when he brings people together. You know, we used to always say he's a rassembleur in French, right? Mm. He is somebody that naturally brings people together. So tapping into that ability in a way that says, I hear your frustration, and then here's how we're going to make it better, I think will be important in the lead up to the next one. I do, though, just want to correct a little bit on polling. For the NDP, it has been, the numbers have been stable, but the where they're getting the vote has changed, right?
Yeah.
So the supply and confidence agreement has shown that they're able to pull voters from the Liberals, but it has also shown that they're losing to the Conservatives.
So there's no seat growth in it.
There is no seat growth, but I would say that is at least better than, you know, losing a bunch of your seat growth.
Okay.
So,
yeah. Okay.
I just want to point out.
Well, we'll see. I mean, it's just polls. We'll see,
totally,
like, once you get to the campaign.
Polls.
Welcome back to this special holiday edition of Power and Politics. And today we've been going over what to expect in budget 2024 and assessing the state of politics so far this year. The budget is going to be tabled on April 16th. And the Liberals are trying to show they're on a prudent track, while the Conservatives are painting the Liberals as big spenders contributing to the affordability problems, while the NDP is looking to hit more targets of their supply and confidence agreement with the governing Liberals. Now we're going to open the floor to our political insiders, Greg McEachern, Melanie Richet, and Fred DeLory. All right, Greg, we saw some moves from the government on rent, on child care, some announcements before the budget to try to give a boost to the budget. What else are you looking forward to? Where do you think they are on this?
Well, those announcements are to present a different type of style after several budgets that just didn't seem to get a lot of impact. So you'll see in the lead up to the budget continuing more pre-announcements. A lot of focus on Gen Z and millennials. I talked to a young woman, she's doing her PhD, she's in her late 20s. I asked her, you know, why are you off the Liberals? And she said, there's just nothing there for us. And look, as a single income person with no kids, there's never anything in a budget for us. But as a Generation X, I had the opportunity to get into the housing market that, you know, millennials might not have. So the government's well aware of that. And I think there's similar themes, sorry, Fred, to the fall economic statement, where it's going to be around housing and affordability and in improving the economy. The big emphasis, the lens to look through this is, what can this government do to help the Bank of Canada reduce interest rates? We've had some great things happen. We had inflation down to 2.8%. A lot of people did not see that coming. Fingers crossed that that continues to happen. But they're trying to create the economic atmosphere to improve the economy and not upset the Bank of Canada.
So Fred, inflation is slowed down. It's still above target, but it's moving in a good direction for everybody in the hopes that it could lead to something later this year from Tiff Macklem. But I mean, in the absence of something that the bank might do, what do you think the Liberals can do on budget day to kind of push things in their direction?
Well, there's two parts to it. One is obviously something to help improve the economy, as Greg pointed, and to your point, to get those inflation rates down, the interest rates down.
Right.
That's what's killing people right now. That's what, you know, my mortgage has doubled in the last few years. Mm-hmm. And a lot of Canadians are suffering from this. And when this, their budget needs to be tied to that. But what they need ultimately is a narrative to come through with this, a plan to show, you know, we've seen the two announcements this week. There's going to be lots of different announcements leading up to it. Is there an overarching theme to this budget about how they're getting the economy going again, how they're going to tackle all of these issues for Canadians? And if they do that, and if they can tell the story, then when and if those interest rates start coming down, they can start having, you know, our plan is working, whatever it's called, and pushing that out. You know, we talk about the fall economic statement. We talk about little pieces of it that we still talk about. I don't know what the theme was of that. We forgot about it. They need a cohesive plan in this budget. And, you know, I'm going to look for that. I was interested to see if they actually do it.
I think mostly the theme with the Feds was that you had no interest in it, said it wouldn't mean anything, and we keep making you talk about it. I think that's kind of, at least for this little group before.
That's the reason why you bring it up.
I mean, it's fun for me. But you know, Mel, Fred has a point there, right? Mm-hmm. That usually you want to use a budget to show your economic vision for the economy, but then also your social vision through helps and programs for families and working Canadians. And every provincial government I ever covered back in Newfoundland would do stuff in advance to the budget to sow the ground and then have a couple of surprises on budget day. Right. We've rarely seen that with this government. Mm-hmm. And instead, you know, we hear a lot of narrative about where we are in direct foreign investment and rankings with the OECD, which means nothing to me as my mortgage double. So, like, how do they craft a narrative with Minister Freeland as the point person for this that they can start selling to Canadians in the time they have left?
Right. And if it, you know, means nothing to you on your mortgage, that's, you know, how the majority of people feel. And what we may be seeing differently this time is some campaigning in the lead up to the budget. And I'm assuming if there's some campaigning in the lead up, there's also going to be some campaigning afterwards as well, mm-hmm. which I think is quite different than how they've done the last few budgets. And may speak to their recognition that they don't necessarily have a message that's punching through, and maybe that's a little bit of a workshop way around it. You spoke about, you know, millennials and Gen Z feeling disconnected from this government, and I'll go back to 2015 when, you know, everybody in my universe had hopped on to voting for Justin Trudeau, being inspired by Justin Trudeau and hopeful. I'm a millennial who has not bought a home, who is desperately trying to buy a home. And now in my conversations with people, when I'm hoping to do that this year, and I'm, when I'm having those conversations, people are saying, you know, the market's starting to heat up again. It kind of lulled for a while. It's starting to heat up again. Everything is pointing to interest rates potentially coming down this summer. And people, both builders and folks who are looking for a home, are starting to pay a little bit more attention to that. So if the government is able to kind of spur that with their measures in the budget, then I think whether they're able to punch through on their message in the lead up to the budget or afterwards or not, it gives them a lot more space to kind of take some of that anger narrative that Pierre Poilievre has been able to put forward and point to how the measures that they've put forward are helping relieve the pressure that people are feeling.
So, Greg, a lot of those millennials that voted for the Liberals in 2015, many of them wanted to buy legal weed back then. Now they want to buy a home, as Mel is outlining it. And this is the number one frustrating issue. And really, for all the argument about carbon pricing, it's interest rates and housing costs that are killing people right now. So how do they attack that? In this budget, because it is an interest rate problem and there may not be a government policy solution.
Yeah, and I would say the added challenge to this is we still kind of don't know the collective psyche post-pandemic and how that affects. You know, we had phrases like the Great Resignation. And so people have considered, you know, what do they really want to do for work? How hard do they want to work? Where do they want to work? Do they want a job where they can work from home? So all of those things are really tough for a government to try to handle. And I really don't see the Conservatives lowering expectations on how they would be able to, you know, just come in, turnkey operation, we're going to run and everything's going to be better. So I think part of it is just the messaging so that millennials and Gen Z feel like they're heard. The other thing that I've noticed in reading some takes from U.S. pollsters and I believe, you know, some pollsters on your show is there is some speculation about whether or not that generation in terms of polling is saying one thing in a poll, but parking that, hoping that the party that they want to support, in this case, you know, the Liberals would want it to be them, that they're parking that anger and come an election, they'll come back.
Yeah, and Fred, you mentioned that people are parking their votes with Pierre Poilievre earlier. We saw a bit of that in the U.S. elections where it looked like Republicans would win certain off-cycle elections, but then when people had to make a choice on the issues, they went to Biden because of all the various things with the GOP. That is not saying that's going to happen with the Conservatives, but that's the poll theory Greg was positing there. So in terms of like getting that vote to unpark itself, is the budget even a means that they can do? I mean, they're trying to keep deficits below a certain level to demonstrate to people they're trying to bend spending back into a good direction, but still with all of these demands and issues that need to be addressed.
Yeah, look, they have their work cut out for them. It's going to be very tough to turn this whole situation around. The economic side of it, as I said earlier, they've got to have something that makes people feel like they're getting ahead for the first time in a few years. People feel like they're falling behind. They're falling behind on bills. They're struggling with things. Prices are going up. It's a monumental task, a very difficult thing for a government to turn around. It's their only shot at this, though, at getting reelected, is to do this and to succeed.
So, Mel, and we got about 60 seconds left. Changing how people feel about their own personal financial circumstances is well beyond just better comms and messaging, right? Totally. The reality in their lives has to change.
Absolutely, absolutely. And the I think inability for the Liberals to kind of see that and to feel that has been reflected in the last few months and have an opportunity with the budget to change tone, change messaging, but also with these policies that if, you know, they help interest rates come down. And they've been a little bit specific with their policies with the help from the NDP on exactly that so that it wouldn't make the problem worse and better. I think a lot can be said, though, about just being heard and about being acknowledged that you're going through a hard time. And we haven't seen that from this government. So I do think that combined with, you know, the economy doing a little bit better could go a long way for this government if the other parties aren't able to take it to their advantage and also push it with their narrative of they are actually better positioned to meet people where they're at and to help in a better way.
Okay, Greg, in 10 seconds, if the Liberals could write the headline for the budget coverage, what does Chrystia Freeland and Justin Trudeau hope it would be?
Better days ahead.
Pierre Poilievre might like that one, too. That's the problem with a headline like that. All right, we got to leave it there. I want to thank our Political Pulse panel, Greg McKecker, Melanie Richet, and Fred DeLoria. You can see them with me every Friday night right here on Power and Politics.
That's it for today. If you like this episode, please follow the pod and catch our next live show on CBC News Network. We're on weekdays at 5 p.m. Eastern Time. I'm David Cochran. Thanks for listening.
For more CBC podcasts, go to cbc.ca/podcasts.